From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. The U.S. government may be pulling back from space missions, but that's left an opening. We have in the studio with us a man who's going through it. Last week, President Obama's plan to fund a mission to land on an asteroid was thwarted when the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology authorized a bill that will specifically prohibit the space agency from moving forward on the plan. As funding battles stall our government's space programs, the private sector is moving forward. Bellevue, Washington is the home of a company that plans to not just land on an asteroid, but to mine it for resources. The company is called Planetary Resources, and the president and chief engineer is Chris Lewicki. Chris used to work at NASA, where he was flight director for two of the Mars rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. Chris has an asteroid named after him, 13609 Lewicki. Chris, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate you being here.
It's a pleasure as always. It's an exciting topic to talk about.
It's expensive to mine on Earth. It takes a lot of money to fly a rocket to an asteroid, land it, set up a mining operation, and bring that material back to Earth. It has to be really expensive. How do you pencil this out at Planetary Resources?
Well, it's really because the potential of those resources is so great. Mining on Earth, of course, fuels all the different sorts of things that we've been doing for as long as we've been industrial human beings. And if we plan on moving off the planet and into the solar system, it's the resources of space that will enable that.
It seems to be have something to do with what kind of prices you could get for these minerals. I mean, are they at the level now where you could afford to actually do this and make money off of it?
Well, so the easiest one to understand are the platinum group metals. These are things that cost $1,600 an ounce or $50,000 a kilogram, and they're some of the rarest materials on their planet, even rarer than the rare earth elements, which get talked about frequently. But there's a material out there that actually has an even higher price, and that is any material that you put into space. It costs $10,000 for each kilogram or each pound of material you put out into space. And if you want to send it beyond just the International Space Station in low Earth orbit, that price can go up to five times or more as much. So if we can get those resources in space and use them in space, they are worth $50,000 a pound.
How do you know an asteroid has the minerals you're looking for?
Well, this is the great thing with asteroids. We have been bombarded by them for a long time. We have 50,000 samples of them in our laboratories. And as many of your listeners might know, Chelyabinsk, Russia was the most recent recipient, not according to their will, but an asteroid that actually came in over their city on February 15th of this year. So we can analyze those. We can look at the materials that are in them. And we can connect that with the astronomy that groups here at University of Washington and University of Victoria across the Sound are doing in understanding how our solar system formed.
But Chris, how do you know that the minerals in that asteroid that landed here are going to be in that asteroid that you're going to land your rocket ship on to mine?
That is our task today at Planetary Resources. While it might be asteroid mining, that's our aspiration, our vocation today actually is prospecting. So people like myself who've worked at NASA, many of my friends that I've brought over with the company who also worked with JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, with Spirit, Opportunity, and the most recent Curiosity rover, and then a number of other smart people from a variety of industries are working on reducing the cost of building spacecraft so that we can visit these asteroids and make that connection.
Will the prospecting and perhaps eventually the mining involved manned space travel?
We don't think so. We think that with the progression of technology and the autonomy that we have and all the information technologies that are being pioneered by Seattle area companies and worldwide will actually enable this to be entirely robotic, much like we've explored all the planets to date.
Now, I've read that asteroids have really eccentric orbits. They're hard to pin down. They go really fast. Is it a lot harder to land on an asteroid than it is to land on a planet?
It's a matter of perspective. In the rocket science standpoint, asteroids are actually some of the most accessible destinations in the solar system. Even the moon is out there every night, and it seems very close. Because of its gravity, it actually requires more rocket fuel to land on it and then to take back off. So there's actually about 15% of all of the near-Earth asteroids out there that are easier to land on. And this is something that as human beings and our space agency here in the U.S. and other governments have been demonstrating that we have the technology to do this and solve this problem for the last 50 years. And it's something that is within reach of commercial companies like ours today.
Has anyone ever landed a rocket on an asteroid?
It's actually happened twice. already. There has been the U.S. mission, the Near Shoemaker probe, which was the first mission to a near-Earth asteroid. I actually worked on that mission when I was in college at the University of Arizona. And that mission, at the end of its life, touched down and rests today on 433 Eros, the very first near-Earth asteroid discovered. And then the Japanese, about 6 years ago, actually landed on, not once, but twice, and retrieved a very small sample from the asteroid Itokawa. And they have brought that back to here to Earth and have analyzed that in laboratories. And that's the first sample that has ever been returned from an asteroid.
How kind of heavy would a viable payload have to be to bring back from an asteroid? And what are the technical challenges of that?
Well, with a small payload, you can bring back a small piece of an asteroid. With a larger one, you can bring back a larger piece. The real exciting thing is looking at reuse. And of course, you can make many trips with a vehicle. You can think of it like a truck. And if we can essentially set up a transportation system where we're able to periodically bring back material wherever it's needed, whether that's the surface of the Earth, whether it's an orbiting space station, or maybe a fuel depot near the moon or on the way to Mars, these are things that we're talking about establishing infrastructure, much like we have here on Earth. We're just doing it in space as we continue to extend our reach.
Chris Lewicki is with us. He's talking about prospecting and eventually mining for minerals on asteroids. He used to work for NASA, and now he is with a Bellevue company called Planetary Resources. If this is something that interests you, you might have a question for him. We're at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW or 800-289-5869. Or you could write to us. It's conversation@KUOW.org. Okay, I kind of get the value proposition on very expensive minerals, but you're also talking about prospecting for water. Why would that make sense?
Well, water, as you know, is the essence of life. We're made of this stuff. And water is very useful for supporting not only animal life, but plant life, which is important to the animals. Water is also useful for industry. All of our processes require some amount of water in the process. It also takes on two very unique forms in space. One is that it shields us from radiation, much like the Earth's atmosphere and the magnetosphere. A little bit of water will protect you from that harmful radiation that scientists worry about with humans in space. So that's a very unique thing. And then also, water is a molecule made of hydrogen and oxygen. And those two elements are the elements that have fueled every space shuttle launch that has ever been flown, all 135 of them. And that water to launch all those space shuttles can be found on one relatively small carbonaceous type water-rich asteroid, something that's no larger than the size of this building. And there are millions of those out in space orbiting the sun.
Now, here's one question I have about the economics of this. If you're out mining for very valuable minerals and you find a lot of them and you bring them back, the price of the minerals drops. So all of a sudden, you're not going to be able to make what you maybe thought you were going to. How do you figure that into this mining proposition?
Well, there's two pieces about that story. Certainly, supply and demand factors into that. And even with the mines here on Earth, you don't mine the entire mine in one day. It takes place over time, and the rate that you do that, of course, will be adjusted for the market. The other piece is there's actually an interest in our company with my founders, Eric Anderson, chairman of Space Adventures, and Dr. Peter Diamandis, who is the founder and chairman of the XPRIZE Foundation. The three of us are really interested in creating a future of abundance. And a very brief story on abundance. In the 1850s and 60s, aluminum was one of the rarest metals on the planet. It was so rare that in the United States, when we finished the Washington Monument, we wanted to memorialize it by capping it with a pyramid of solid aluminum. And Napoleon would serve his most important guests on plateware made of aluminum because it was so rare. But of course, when we figured out how to extract it from bauxite, which is very abundant, aluminum became more abundant. And now it's so abundant that you have drink containers made of it, your computer, your phone is made of it, high-voltage power wires are made of it, we fly through tubes of the sky in it, we wrap burritos in it and throw it away. And there's certainly much more that is enabled by aluminum being abundant today than when it was relatively scarce in the 1800s.
Well, there certainly is for society at large. But if you're selling aluminum, you're not making as much money for it. And you've got all these expenses of getting to these asteroids and doing the mining and getting it back.
But your market is much larger.
Oh, okay. You think you'll sell more of these materials the more you bring down from space?
Well, the platinum group elements in particular, the six elements that form up there, are some of the most useful elements that we know of. They are excellent catalysts. Everyone has platinum group metals in every automobile on the planet as a catalytic converter because it helps shield out the harmful contaminants in the exhaust. And we use it in energy storage and actually in creation of about a quarter of any consumer product that you buy, whether it's a flat panel TV, whether it's silicone rubbers, or even parts of the oil industry, all depend on the platinum group metals. And the best engineers and scientists and chemists on the planet are working hard because of the cost of platinum to figure out how to design it out of these processes. Imagine if they could figure out how to use that material and design it in to use the very best material that's available for whatever we're designing.
Chris Lewicki is telling us about his Bellevue-based company called Planetary Resources, where the plan is to mine asteroids for minerals and also water. What's the timeline, Chris? When do you actually, you've already kind of accomplished one thing. We have landed on asteroids. That has been done. How about the actual landing, the prospecting, the finding the minerals and bringing them back? When do you think that'll happen?
We're starting with building spacecraft and doing this in a way that it's cheaper than the billion-dollar missions that have been done as government enterprises before. We're launching the first of these next year in the spring from the International Space Station. And listeners might also be aware that we just finished a very successful crowdfunding campaign on Kickstarter, where we gave backers in the Kickstarter community opportunity to actually take part in our mission on our ARCID 100 space telescope.
I want to ask you about that in a moment. So maybe one of your missions will go next year, and then where from there do you actually see this beginning to happen? When would these minerals from asteroids be arriving back from to Earth?
So we'll get our first missions out to asteroids by the end of this decade, as it was so boldly declared in earlier decades. And from there, we'll take the first tentative steps of touching down on the surface with a payload that will acquire some of that material and run a process to extract those first bits of water. And it'll start small to begin with, maybe a test tube, maybe just a liter of water. And we'll either store that locally or bring it back for study. And then as we start to demonstrate that this is actually a viable source of materials to fuel future satellites, we can scale up from there. So this is something that I think will become a matter of practice in the 2020s, and it's something that is very consistent with the timescale of establishing mines here on Earth. It often takes 10, 20, 30 years from identifying where you're going to build the mine to the point that it's operational.
So your investors have to be looking at a long-term return here. This is not going to be a quarter-to-quarter thing.
Yeah, we do have some visionary investors. You can check out on our website, planetaryresources.com, people like Larry Page, who folks might recognize as the one of the founders and the current CEO of Google, Charles Simone, local to the area here, famous with Microsoft, and a number of other people. Most recently, we announced that Sir Richard Branson joined our investor group, and he's been involved in music and airlines, but he also has another space enterprise called Virgin Galactic. So Richard has a high interest in developing space as well.
And then I want to get back to this. You mentioned that successful Kickstarter campaign you had. It was to raise $1 million. You ended up with $1.5 million for what you're calling a space telescope for everyone. What's that?
It's about the opportunity, because these things don't cost billions of dollars anymore, and because we're a private entity, not a government agency, we could actually bring people along directly in the experience, not just show them the pictures, but let them take the pictures. Let them actually put their hand on the wheel, decide where we're going to point the telescope, or even share that experience with a classroom here local in Seattle or anywhere in the world. And also, we have 16,000 people who have backed us with what has become known as the Space Selfie. And this is your face in space. It's a very simple idea, but it connects people to the cosmos in a way that they've never been able to do before. And it's a way for you to have a very unique kind of memory and your imprint on the universe.
What can be seen from a space telescope that can't be seen from an Earth telescope?
Well, in Seattle, of course, we can see through the clouds in the winter when we're orbiting up above them. There are also parts of the electromagnetic spectrum that don't get through the atmosphere because it gets absorbed in the atmosphere. And then we have the benefit that that we don't have that weather in the way, kind of unsteadying the picture, and we can spend a lot longer time staring at a particular target because we don't have to take the rotation of the Earth into account. So even though our telescope isn't quite as big as the Hubble Space Telescope with 20 years of advance in technology, there are things that we'll be doing that will be beyond the state of the art of what the most funded NASA missions have been. And that's the exciting part about this for me, having been part of those NASA missions, seeing the opportunity for small teams of people with private funding being able to do things that previously only governments could do.
Yeah, you mentioned your co-founders, Eric Anderson, who's involved in space tourism, and Peter Diamandis with the XPRIZE. You guys just didn't just get together on this. You met back in college, is that right?
Eric and I were presidents of our respective chapters of Students for the Exploration and Development of Space, SEDS, or SEDS for short. I was at the University of Arizona. He was at University of Virginia. And we were connected to Peter because Peter, as a student 10 years prior at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, founded the organization. And we were all space nuts from the beginning. Eric went on to found Space Adventures. Peter founded the International Space University and started the XPRIZE. And we've been working on projects a lot. And after I had some experience at NASA, we got together to take on the next big task.
So would the college student Chris Lewicki, looking into the future, be not at all surprised with the Chris Lewicki of today?
A little bit surprised, I think.
What would he be surprised about?
Just things are moving, and it goes back to an adage. I think you overpredict what's possible in 1 year. We're always very optimistic, but you underpredict what's possible in 10 years. And in the last 10 years, we've seen just an amazing amount of innovation, of exploration, of increase in knowledge. And it's hard to fathom what the world would be like in 2023 and the things that we're considering at
that
point.
We'll have you back to talk about it, if not before.
Yeah, absolutely.
Chris Lewicki, thank you so much for stopping by. Chris is a NASA veteran, flight director for the Mars rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. Now he's president and chief engineer at Bellevue-based Planetary Resources, where they're planning to mine the asteroids. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.